From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
This rocking Baptist minister has surged past three of his better-known
Iowa lives. Republicans falling hard for a guitar-playing former Arkansas
governor. The Huckabee
support
was 8% among likely voters in Iowa in July. Now it's 24%. What's behind it?
The hot, hot, hot presidential candidate this week is former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who, according to the most recent Rasmussen poll of Iowa Republican voters, has surged from presumed also-ran to front-runner. Along the way, he has charmed punditry's heavy hitters. CNN's David Gergen finds the former Southern Baptist minister, quote, human and authentic. Huckabee has impressed conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks as funny and engaging. Even New Yorker magazine's liberal Hendrik Hertzberg found Huckabee's disinclination toward Bible-thumping zealotry, quote, almost impossible not to like. But not completely impossible. Back in Little Rock, the charm offensive has set some eyes to rolling. Max Brantley is editor of the weekly Arkansas Times.
I've really been surprised at the utter absence of reporting that's been done on Mike Huckabee. There are very legitimate issues on the national stage, whether it's his fair tax proposal or his stance on some social issues that deserve some examination, but they've been put to the side to focus on his jokes and his charming manner and his pardoning of a Rolling Stones guitar player.
It's a familiar complaint. Local reporters have often chafed at the national press's infatuation with political figures regarded close to home as decidedly less than favorite sons. On Friday, questions about Rudolph Giuliani's mayoral record made page one of his hometown, New York Times, a stark contrast to the familiar narrative of 9/11 heroics. It recalled a conversation I had back in February with longtime Newsday columnist Ellis Hennekin. Is it your sense that the New York media as a group is sort of champing at the bit to let the outside world know about their Rudy?
I think we have some insights that the rest of the world maybe hasn't tuned into yet.
This is precisely Max Brantley's complaint. Huckabee, he says, has become the newest darling of the national media without any due diligence. He cites, for instance, a laundry list of Huckabee's brushes with the Arkansas Ethics Commission, something he wishes those national columnists would take the time to learn about.
I think they ought to review his long and unseemly record on grasping for material goods and question what public service is really about.
Help me understand here. Material goods?
Well, when he first became governor, he turned a mansion operating account into a personal expense account, bought a doghouse, did his dry cleaning, bought his restaurant meals with it. He also first claimed as his own $70,000 worth of furniture that a cotton grower donated to the governor's mansion for the private living quarters. He said very angrily that it was his furniture. Then he found out that it would be against the law for him to claim it as his own, and he said he was misunderstood and misquoted.
And then there was a question of a wedding registry.
He went out the way he came in. He set up a so-called wedding registry at a couple of department stores so that friends and admirers could buy presents for them to stock their new private home. They called it a wedding registry because the department stores didn't have a rake-in loot from my friend's account. It was the only way you could register. This was some 30 years after they got married, by the way.
That is so brazen. It's, you know, on the verge of unbelievable, but it's all a matter of public record.
Well, here we have a word for it. It's called tacky. And this was legal at the time he did much of this. The question is it seemly for a public official to do it? He believes, by the way, that this is perfectly acceptable. It follows a pattern and practice of being a preacher in a Southern congregation where your congregation frequently showers you with love offerings, and he apparently views being governor as something akin to being a pastor.
Now, let me ask you this. You are editor of a muckraking liberal alt-weekly.
Guilty.
Why shouldn't our listeners dismiss this as personal or ideological animus from you, or even a kind of crusade to bring disrepute on an Arkansas favorite son?
Well, certainly a lot of people will draw that conclusion. The funny thing about Mike Huckabee and me is that the things he gets the most grief about from conservatives are things that I think are shining stars on his record. That is, backing a number of tax increases for vital services in Arkansas. We endorsed his efforts in those regard and do today, and my hat's off to him for it.
But what about conservative journalists in Arkansas? Do you think that they throw in with you in the notion that the national press has just missed a lot about Huckabee? Are they as frustrated as you are?
Well, I don't know if they have the same degree of frustration, but I think it's interesting you mentioned the rest of the press. There's a former staff member of Mike Huckabee, a conservative Republican who's now a columnist for a news organization in Arkansas, wrote a column this week about the fact that Mike Huckabee is more about Mike Huckabee, a desire for self-aggrandizement and to be a TV performer, than he is about it, in some ways, about being a serious candidate. So I could refer you to his work. I could refer you to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, which is a Republican editorial page, which has called him selfish and petty at times. And I'd point quickly to Quinn Hillier, who's a senior editor for the American Spectator. And for those who don't know, it's a very conservative publication in Washington. He's a former Arkansas Democrat Gazette editorial writer. He called him nasty with a mean, vindictive streak and talked about his ethical miscues. So I think that's something that somebody from the far left and the far right have come together in the middle on.
Isn't political reporting, though, quite self-correcting in this respect? I mean, to the degree that he succeeds in Iowa and the national polls and becomes a more serious contender, don't you think that there will be total immersion in Arkansas of the national press and all of this stuff will be amply reported?
Tain't necessarily so is what I would say. I think the Bush record didn't get fully and completely reported until his second term. Already, where there has been some additional reporting on Mike Huckabee, it's been dismissed by commentators in some cases as either A, the product of the crazy uncle in the basement of Arkansas journalism, that is me, or B, just material that's being put out by his opponents and somehow dismissed because it's opposition research as opposed to something else. I call it facts, either way you shape it.
All right, Max, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Max Brantley is editor of the Arkansas Times. Voters have always had to ponder the issue of electability. Do I vote for my favorite candidate among those who have a chance to win, or do I risk squandering my ballot on a vote of principle? In this year's primary race, that calculation has come to be a central question, if not the central question. Jason Zangerli wrote about the issue of electability in New York Magazine. He says it plays an unprecedented role in the way we think of the candidates.
You know, I was talking to one campaign aide for one of the Democratic campaigns for this story, and he said that in their internal polls of Iowa caucus goers, electability is now the number one issue of the caucus goers they talk to. It's more important to them than Iraq. So if you're a reporter and you can simply say, well, if the voters are considering electability as one of their main criteria, that's how I'm going to assess the candidates as well. And it allows the media to sort of play the horse race politics game with a little bit less of a guilty conscience.
If you read newspapers, you will encounter electability as an issue that's discussed. If you watch 24-hour cable news, it is inescapable. Why is it such an attractive concept for CNN and Fox and so forth?
Because it's an unanswerable question, at least for the next year. And you know, if you have 24 hours of programming to fill, you can keep on going around and around and around on that same topic. The most interesting thing about the fact that electability gets talked about so much on cable news is if you go to Iowa or you go to New Hampshire and you know you go to a political event and you watch a candidate speak, and then you go up to the a voter or a caucus goer afterwards and you ask them what they think about the candidate, very rarely, it seems, will they mention the war or healthcare or anything like that. They'll immediately start talking about whether that candidate's electable or not. And you might as well be talking to like Chris Matthews or Tim Russert or someone like that. All these voters out there have become sort of mini pundits themselves, I think, because they spend so much time watching Hardball or watching Keith Olbermann or watching Meet the Press that they just kind of start repeating what those guys say whenever they talk to reporters.
I'm curious whether this whole notion of electability is new or whether it informed the choices in nominating, you know, I don't know, Adlai Stevenson or George McGovern or Walter Mondale or any number of no-chance Democratic nominees.
The term itself actually dates back to 1879, but it didn't really become a big part of the political lexicon, I think, until the latter years of the 20th century, and you started seeing it being used more and more by typically underdog candidates, people like Hart in 84. Dole tried to use it against Bush in 88. Bob Kerry tried to use it against Clinton in 92. I mean, Kerry famously said that the Republicans would open Clinton up like a soft peanut in the general election. And in all of those instances, with the exception of Mondale and Hart, it's typically been an argument of loser candidates, to be honest.
It's particularly interesting this go-around because the front runners of both parties, Hillary Clinton and Rudolph Giuliani, have both been deemed by some pundits to be unelectable in a national election. It's kind of like a resistible force against a movable object. Does it strike you as a bit weird?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely strange. I mean, I think what it ultimately shows is just how squishy a concept electability is. It's completely dependent on context and time, and it can change from one moment to the next.
The Constitution gives each adult American citizen a vote, but has nothing to say about the calculus that we employ in casting that vote. Do you think that there's even a moral issue attached to whether electability should even be something we as citizens consider?
I don't know if it's a moral issue, but maybe a practical issue. I mean, in the past, voters who voted based on electability haven't always shown that they were that smart at handicapping. I mean, I think 2004 is a really good example. You know, if you're a Democratic primary voter in 2004 and you really like Howard Dean, but you decide that you're going to vote for John Kerry because he's more electable, come November 2004, you got to be feeling pretty stupid about that decision. I mean, it turns out this, you know, strategic rational choice you made was completely wrong. But I don't think it's a moral issue necessarily to vote for Kerry over Dean on the grounds that you think Kerry's more electable. If that's why you're voting, you better hope the calculation you're making is correct. And oftentimes it seems it's not. It's a hard thing to assess.
Has electability taken on unprecedented significance in 2007?
Yeah, I think it has. I think this time around, you've never had so many candidates making the electability argument in such a forthright manner, whether it's, you know, Edwards or Obama basically saying they're more electable than Clinton. And then on the Republican side, you have all manner of Republican candidates saying that they're the candidate who can actually beat Clinton in November, whether it's Giuliani or McCain or Romney. McCain's the best example. Last month, his campaign sent out a press release that entitled Good Polling News. And the McCain campaign claimed that there was a recent Fox News poll of a hypothetical matchup between the Republican candidates and Hillary Clinton, and it showed that John McCain, according to the campaign, was the best position to beat Hillary. The only problem with the poll was it did show that McCain did better than all the Republican candidates against Hillary, but McCain still lost to Hillary in this Fox News poll. His electability claim boiled down to the idea that he would lose by less to Hillary Clinton.
Well, Jason, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jason Zengerle wrote about electability for New York Magazine. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Edwards, Obama, Hillary, Giuliani, Romney. Notice anything odd there? I referred to one and only one of those candidates by first name. And we've gotten some mail about this. Genevieve Van Cleve from Austin, Texas wrote, I find it interesting that in so many stories, Senator Clinton is referred to as Hillary. It's remarkable to me. No one refers to the other presidential candidates in news stories or on air just by their first names. It's true. And when we looked through some of our old transcripts, we discovered that Brooke and I have both referred to candidate Clinton as Hillary. Here's a clip of me from an interview I did in October. But the story was, you know, buried inside the New York Times today and inside the Wall Street Journal. Why shouldn't Hillary's progress be relegated to the inside pages as well? Was I wrong? Condescending? Disrespectful? Am I a bad feminist? The OTM production staff is, shall we say, divided on that subject. But as producers went to Hillary Clinton's official campaign website, they were struck by the fact that the word Clinton is barely there. She's running as Hillary. All of the signage says Hillary for president, which made our staff conclude that, if anything, we shouldn't use Hillary simply because it is perhaps what her campaign wants, and we don't want to be taking our cues from them. I'm still not comfortable on that feminism question, though, and I don't even know if I can stop saying it. It just comes out. And that's why I'm curious to hear what Marie Wilson thinks. She runs the White House Project and has long imagined a woman ascending to the highest office. But can she imagine calling a female president by her first name? Marie, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So what's your take on this? Hillary, is this something that institutionally the White House Project is comfortable with?
I have to tell you, when your office called about this, it made me think that I had been doing the same thing, you know, with the press and with the public, referring to her as Hillary. But we have done a great deal of work on how even the most important and popular women in America and the world keep their authority. And I think it's a real mistake. I don't think it's about being a bad feminist or even, you know, accommodating the campaign. I think it's actually a bad mistake with regard to how women keep their authority. On the Republican debate earlier this week, we had an example.
Now, whether we need to send somebody to Mars, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, if we do, I've got a few suggestions, and maybe Hillary could be on the first rocket to Mars.
And the people roared. And I thought to myself, if he had said we should send Senator Clinton out in space, would there have been a different kind of reaction? And I think there might have, because there's respect for that.
I want to ask you about just the simple mechanics of naming names. First of all, the press, at least in second and subsequent references, doesn't use honorifics. Mm-hmm. They simply use last names. And of course, if you call Hillary Clinton simply Clinton, there rises the question of simple confusion of exactly which Clinton you're talking about. That's always been an issue. And I think that's one of the reasons that Hillary branded herself Hillary to begin with, no?
That Hillary branded herself Hillary. Well, I'm sure that's one of the reasons. But again, I want to emphasize we've done several pieces of research in the last few years that really point out how easy it is for, again, a woman who people get too familiar with to lose the kind of authority and the distance she needs to really be a credible candidate. The largest piece of research, by the way, we ever did was one called Barriers and Opportunities. And it was really looking at the ads that women and men had run for governor. And we tested those ads. And what surprised me was when a woman came up on the screen, I don't care who she was, people immediately dialed down to indicate that she wasn't seen as effective. And that's a problem for women.
I want to jump in and say, you know, there's another reason the press is blameless here, because after all, she has been confused about how she wants to be identified from the beginning of our history with her. She was Hillary Rodham. She was Hillary Rodham Clinton. She was the first lady, and which I think probably added to her Hillary-ness. Any thoughts as to how we in the media should deal with this issue?
I really do. I think you should not leave it to women, frankly, who are not always walking around the world thinking about how they maintain their power to do it. I think you have to kind of bend over backwards a little bit to understand that every time you chip away, even inadvertently, at how a woman leader is seen in the world, you do diminish her. And I want to tell you just a piece, though, about what's underneath that. And I would not have guessed this if we hadn't been working on this for the last 9 years, that what's happened is with the public world, women are not seen as authorities because the cultural ideal of women is still wife and mother, not public leader. And so it's very vulnerable the way women can slip back into softness and nurturing and not bad things, but things that don't make you a leader.
Well, Marie, or should I say, wait a second.
What about your high and lifted up holiness or queen? Or I'd like queen.
Majesty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Marie Wilson heads the White House Project, an organization that works to advance women's leadership. There are between 6,000 and 7,000 languages spoken around the world, and nearly half of them face extinction. About once every 2 weeks, a language dies out in remote and sometimes not so remote places. Here in the U.S., in the Pacific Northwest, and in Southwest Oklahoma, indigenous languages face rapid extinction. That's where linguist Greg Anderson comes in. He's director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. He circles the globe trying to record the last remnants of dying tongues. Greg says when a language goes extinct, it takes entire means of expression, bodies of knowledge, ancient narratives, even entire cultures along with it.
It erases the vast majority of the stored knowledge that group of people has accrued. So their own history, knowledge that they've accrued about interacting with their ecosystems, whether it's plant management, animal resource management, you know, fishing techniques, whatever it is, all of this basically is being lost because this knowledge is stored in languages which aren't written, are threatened, and, you know, probably never will be written.
So somewhere in Central South America, in some mountain village, the cure for some disease could be harbored in the language of a tribe and could disappear along with that language.
Absolutely. In fact, the use of quinine against malaria, there is this group that had this knowledge for a long time before Westerners got around to figuring it out.
I guess the most pessimistic view of the phenomenon is that languages disappear through the process of something like cultural imperialism as local cultures become assimilated by the larger culture. But another way of looking at it is that people are trying to make better lives for their children and through education try to become more actively engaged in the larger culture. That's a bit of a conundrum.
There is something to be said about adapting to the reality of the socioeconomics of your environment so that if language X is the one that's going to get you ahead through education, then of course you need to know language X. But that doesn't mean you have to abandon your original heritage identity ever in any sense. There's no reason why you can't adopt the other language just as easily because bilingualism is a normal state for people all around the world.
Now, there are some languages that are undergoing some degree of resurgence. Gaelic is one of them. Can you give me some examples?
Here in America, probably the greatest success story would belong to Hawaiian. 30 or 40 years ago, Hawaiian was in a very precarious state with very few speakers and very few native speakers at that. And through the efforts of a dedicated group of individuals, you have had a real resurgence in Hawaiian. That's a really great success story. There are some moderate success stories happening. We have one here in Oregon. The Grand Ronde Reservation has been doing a really, really great language immersion program in the Chinook Wawa language, and that's producing a new generation of speakers of that language. So, there's lots of little pockets of success stories for sure. You know, it's not all gloom and doom.
Now, in your work, you actually go to remote parts of the world with tape recording equipment to try to preserve languages. And sometimes you arrive in very out-of-the-way places only to discover that, the challenges are pretty substantial. Tell me some of what you've experienced.
We arrive in this community in central Siberia, and this language was last visited by linguists 30-plus years previously, so we weren't really sure if we were going to find any speakers at all because the language was already in a precarious state then. The first village we end up in, the mayor of the town gets this guy to help us, and he takes us to another village down the road, and we go there, and the first guy we meet is completely deaf, and he's also missing all of his teeth. And so, you know, he's not an ideal consultant for a variety of reasons. He can't understand anything you say, and he also has serious trouble pronouncing things. So then they took us down the street to an elderly woman who both had all her teeth and not deaf, but just completely senile. So she was, she was an absolute character because she would intermittently, hug us and then start swearing at us, like, who are you and what are you doing here? And then, I love you 2 minutes later. And if your two people are someone who's completely deaf and someone who's really, not connected into our personal understanding of reality, then you really have no chance of working with them. So that language is effectively dead. As it turns out, we were able to find people that did, in fact, speak the language, but we managed to only find 5 of those people across this fairly large area. So the language is in an extremely precarious state, but we've begun a very rigorous systematic study since then with these 5 remaining speakers.
The idea of recording the last speakers to put in some sort of virtual warehouse to me suggests that scene in Fahrenheit 451 where in a society where all the books are burned, a handful of people repair to the forest where they learn books by heart and, become the last living connection to a world where there is freedom of expression. If 5 or 6 languages, Russian and Mandarin and English and Spanish, dominate the world, are we facing some sort of linguistic totalitarianism?
I don't know if I go that far, but what we are definitely facing is the loss of the vast majority of what we could ever know about the human mind as expressed through language. Language is a very integral part of being human, and different systems of slicing up the human experience and expressing that as different languages do through words and grammar and whatnot. There's only so many of those that ever will occur. But when we're faced with a world in which only Indonesian, Chinese, Spanish, English, and Arabic and a few other languages still exist, just a tiny fraction of what humans once did will be ever knowable. And that's really a daunting and horrible thought, but that is the reality that we're facing.
Greg, thank you so much.
Bob, thanks for having me.
Greg Anderson is the director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. While some languages are dying rapid deaths, even as we speak, others, like our own, are adding words all the time. A challenge for any lexicographer tasked with monitoring the words we speak or write or invent. Each year, the new Oxford American Dictionary chooses a single word of the year and a list of runners-up, all candidates for future inclusion in their next edition. Ben Zimmer, editor at Oxford University Press, joins me now to discuss a few you may already be using but won't yet find in the reference books. Ben, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with your choices for word of the year because for many neologisms, the etymologies, or at least the original coiners, are unknown. This one's different. We know a lot about the way this particular word was developed, and so I'm going to hand it over to you.
The word of the year is?
That was the drum roll.
Yes. The word of the year is locavore. Locavore means someone who endeavors to eat only locally produced foods. And as you were saying, it's a word that we know exactly when and where it was coined. In 2005, there was a group of four women in San Francisco who challenged Bay Area residents to eat only food that was grown in a 100-mile radius, and they called themselves the locavores.
Now, when I saw the word, I immediately understood, yeah, got locavore, got it locally grown produce. Does anyone actually use it?
Well, it's being used quite a lot by the local food movement, either locavore or there's another variant form that's often used, localvore, with an extra L in the middle. And at the moment, those two forms are battling it out a little bit. But the original form and currently the more popular form is locavore.
Now, one of your runners-up rhymes with locavore, more or less, and it is mumblecore, which I'm sure hasn't really become mainstream yet, but has been propagated largely by journalists.
Well, mumblecore is a name that was given to an independent film movement in the U.S., which has low-budget production, mostly non-professional actors with dialogue that's mostly improvised. It became popularized, actually, at the South by Southwest Film Festival when a director mentioned this word, and then the media ran with it. It started appearing in the New York Times and Village Voice talking about mumblecore, this new American film movement.
Now, what would it take for mumblecore or locavore to actually find its way into the dictionary when the next edition comes out?
Well, we would need to see these words being used more widely, also not so self-consciously, so not just talking about the word.
Before we get to the next runner-up, I'm going to play this piece of tape.
I didn't do anything! Don't tase me, bro! Don't tase me! I didn't do anything! Ow! Ow! Ow!
That was from the Florida incident where a university student was stunned with a taser. And the words that came from his mouth, don't tase me, bro, I've heard that formulation before. Why is it just now being recognized by your editors?
Well, this is actually not a new word. There's actually a 1988 Houston Chronicle newspaper article in which a police sergeant says, well, the prisoner was getting rowdy and so he had to tase him. So clearly it's been used in law enforcement circles and elsewhere for quite a while. But this year, thanks in large part to YouTube, the Don't Tase Me Bro incident was seen by hundreds of thousands of people. And then it became a catchphrase that started showing up on bumper stickers and T-shirts and so forth. And so even though this isn't a new word, it's certainly a newly prominent word in 2007.
The next coinage, previver.
Previver is a word that is used to refer to a person who hasn't been diagnosed with cancer but has survived a genetic predisposition for cancer or may have precancerous cells. So someone who doesn't have full-fledged cancer but could possibly develop it becomes known as a previver amongst this community.
I want to ask you one final thing. It seems that nowadays no subject, and not even etymology, is immune from partisan politics. And there have been charges from those on the political right who have noticed that last year, your word of the year was carbon neutral, which is vaguely tree-hugging. And this year's is locavore, also environmentally minded, that Oxford American Dictionary has a environmental activist bias. You are a front organization for the eco-lobby. How do you plead?
We're simply observers, and what we've been observing is that the environmental movement or the green movement has been having a tremendous impact on the English language and new vocabulary that develops. And so we're not trying to promote or advocate a particular agenda, but we're noticing what is significant in terms of new additions to the language. And clearly, the rise in environmental awareness is having a big effect, and we're seeing that in many of the words that are entering English now.
Okay, Ben. Well, listen, I'm going to go grab something to vore, but in the meantime, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ben Zimmer is editor of American Dictionaries for the Oxford University Press, where the word of the year is locavore.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. December 1st marks World AIDS Day, and events worldwide will remember the 25 million people who've succumbed to the disease and focus renewed attention on HIV prevention and treatment. But on November 20th, the United Nations AIDS Organization, UNAIDS, and the World Health Organization released a report that scaled down the official number of people infected with HIV worldwide. Scaled down, that is, by over 6 million people. That still leaves 33.2 million suffering from a devastating disease, but it raises questions about official data and journalistic responsibility when reporting on numbers of this scale. Daniel Halperin is a senior research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. He says that his research has shown that even this latest revision of the numbers may still be an overstatement.
We actually had a paper over 3 years ago in the medical journal The Lancet where we estimated that the total number of people living with HIV or AIDS was probably roughly in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 million. And I would say that's probably still the case. So even the current 33 million estimate is probably a bit on the high side. But the actually larger adjustment last week from UNAIDS and WHO is not in the total number of people with HIV, but it's the estimate of the number of people becoming newly infected each year. That had been about 4.3 million last year, and that estimate has now been revised to 2.5 million. So that's a discrepancy of over 40%. That's actually a much larger correction. Furthermore, in the new data, they are saying now the rate of new infections, what we call HIV incidence, has actually been declining since the late 1990s.
The media are often criticized for being credulous, especially from governmental sources. But I suppose there is a tendency to assume that statistics that they're getting from the World Health Organization, for example, would be reliable. It's, for crying out loud, it's the World Health Organization. Is there anything that news organizations can do to make sure that the numbers they get, you know, have some relationship to reality?
One of the lessons of this situation and some others is that just as reporters have learned over the years to be skeptical about numbers and about reports that are issued by, you know, for example, our own government, I think they have to have the same approach when dealing with international bodies like WHO. There was an analysis done by a colleague here at Harvard University. He was formerly at the WHO, Chris Murray, and they analyzed the top 10 leading killers worldwide, HIV/AIDS, of course, being in that list of 10. And according to their analysis, 9 out of the 10 causes of death were all overestimated. So this is not just a phenomenon that's unique to HIV/AIDS. you know, UNAIDS describes itself as in part an advocacy organization. And it's, I think, a little bit problematic for the same organization that is admittedly an activist organization for fundraising and so on to also be the same organization that issues the official statistics.
An inherent conflict of interest.
Potentially, certainly. And I think they acknowledge that. And this, in the report that was issued last week, one of the recommendations is to have much more independent external review of the methodology's use.
About 10 years ago, I did an op-ed in USA Today where I simply added up the statistics given by various, you know, disease advocacy groups about the number of people afflicted with arthritis, with heart disease, with lung cancer, and so forth. And I added them all up, and it turned out that everyone in the United States was multiply afflicted and, you know, about three times over. And that as a nation, you know, we were all going to die like tomorrow, which I would say casts some doubt on the statistic generation process. When you see numbers in the press about HIV/AIDS or anything else, you know, do you just tend to roll your eyes knowing that they are likely to be inflated for political reasons or any other?
Sure. I mean, all the time. I mean, just as a common example, we're now 25 years into this epidemic. And still to this day, journalists and leading newspapers will say in country X, 1/4 of the population has HIV. When in fact, the actual statistic is in the worst affected countries, 25% of adults have HIV, which actually means that about 12 or 13% of the total population has HIV. So that's a very common error. For me, there's sort of a couple important take-home implications. One is it's still a terrible problem. Even if it were as low as 25 million people globally, that's still a lot of people with a potentially fatal disease. I hope that nobody takes away from this that, well, there's no such thing as an HIV/AIDS problem. It's complete hype. And the second point is that I'm worried about a potential boy who cried wolf syndrome here. I mean, already there have been bloggers on the internet in the last week or two who are saying, you see, this whole HIV/AIDS thing was hype. It didn't turn out to be the cataclysmic pandemic that it was made out to be. Things like global warming is going to turn out to be the same.
I want to ask you one final thing. In no way to diminish the significance of this epidemic worldwide, I'm wondering if the fascination with HIV/AIDS, because it's so horrific, if it has pushed aside public health issues that are as important or even more pressing than HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, I think that's true for a number of reasons. I mean, I think, you know, one of the reasons people, I imagine that people get so interested in this disease, and I have to confess it's part of the reason that drew me to studying it many years ago, is, you know, it deals with some fundamental issues of human existence, sexuality, death, and so on. Clearly, the media has helped focus attention on a major health problem, HIV/AIDS, and it's had spill-offs more recently in terms of other diseases like tuberculosis and malaria. So we've gotten people focused on Africa, but there's about two or three different songs in the playbook that people just keep hitting. You know, the sort of gloom and doom, the orphan lying in the ditch by the side of the village somewhere. That button gets pressed over and over. The issue around the Bush administration's abstinence policies, that's constantly brought up to the detriment of talking about other aspects of prevention. But I'm concerned this snafu around the HIV/AIDS number, I would hate to see that slow down momentum on addressing other diseases and other problems that are more boring, like diarrheal diseases, diseases related to lack of access to safe water, and increasingly issues related to climate change that maybe aren't as sexy and don't get as much attention, but certainly kill lots of people.
Daniel, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Daniel Halperin is a senior research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. For solutions to health crisis, economic instability, and violent conflict in Africa, many look to improve education. And in 2005, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Nicholas Negroponte, computer science expert and co-founder of the MIT Media Lab, unveiled a simple, if ambitious, plan to address education in the developing world. To get a laptop that costs $100 into the hands of 150 million poor school children in just 4 years. World leaders were enthusiastic in their support, and companies like Google and News Corporation pitched in millions of dollars to the cause. But 4 years is almost up, and so far only 2,000 students have the laptops, which cost $188, not $100. Steve Stecklow of the Wall Street Journal first wrote about the $100 laptop in 2005 and has recently written a follow-up. He says Negroponte should have assumed that big computer companies wouldn't let his philanthropic plan proceed without trying to get a piece of the action.
I don't think it's dead in the water, but I think that in trying to execute his plan, there may have been a bit of naivete to think that large companies would sit back and watch in developing countries where there are potentially something like a billion new customers and that they wouldn't try to compete. But in fact, he quickly ran into rather intense competition from the likes of Intel Corporation, whose chips were not in his machine, and Microsoft, and his machine doesn't run Windows.
Early on in the project, a number of countries enthusiastically signed on, only later to renege for a variety of reasons, including, in one case, a military coup, and others because they said $100 million would be far better spent on the most basic of basics, like teachers and even school uniforms, than what they have portrayed as a fancy gadget.
Well, Professor Negroponte has worked in this area for quite some time, and he's seen evidence in Cambodia and other countries where when children are given access to the internet, when they are given access to technology, learning really does go on. The problem is he took a top-down approach, and he got essentially handshake agreements with a number of leaders, including Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, to buy a million laptops each. And some leaders are no longer in power. And also, probably more importantly, is he didn't approach the bureaucrats in these countries, like the ministries of education, to ask them what they wanted. A lot of them, they opposed it, and they raised questions about, hey, look, it doesn't run Windows, and who's going to train our teachers? And these are very legitimate questions. It's just for a long time, he seemed to have avoided those people, and I think that's really hurt him.
Another strategic blunder would seem to be the question of economies of scale. He thought that if he could get these orders for enormous numbers of machines, that he would be able to really undercut the commercial competition. But the commercial competition has far greater capital resources.
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise here was the entry of Intel Corporation, the giant chip maker, which doesn't normally make computers at all. But last year, they introduced a laptop computer called the Classmate, which is being sold for roughly, $230 to $300. It's only offered in the developing world, and it's become the biggest opponent to Mr. Negroponte's machine. For a while, Intel was openly attacking Mr. Negroponte's idea, and he went at it with the chairman, Craig Barrett, of Intel. At one point, Mr. Negroponte was quoted as saying, if I'm pissing off Intel and Microsoft, I must be doing something right. Later, after he appeared on 60 Minutes, attacking Intel again this past May. 2 months later, Intel, in effect, jumped into bed with Mr. Negroponte and gave a multi-million dollar investment in his nonprofit and joined the board of this One Laptop Per Child organization. But what didn't happen is that they didn't stop selling this Classmate laptop in country after country, winning sales in many of the countries that Mr. Negroponte had been counting on.
So let me ask you this, Steve. Negroponte's goal was to make laptops available to the poorest school children in the most disadvantaged countries of the world. But if it turns out that private corporations see those places as potentially lucrative marketplaces and themselves find a way to get their laptops and software into the hands of the poorest school children in the most disadvantaged countries of the world, does it really matter whether Negroponte's laptop project itself succeeds? Hasn't he still achieved his goal?
Well, I would say yes. When I interviewed him and asked him this very question, he did say he would consider it a success if something like 150 million school children in 2008 receive Intel Classmates and not his machine. But the fact is Intel and Microsoft both told me that they look at a 15-year time frame. So it's going to take a lot longer. And I think he should consider it a success. But if you spent more than 2 years developing a unique machine from scratch and actually built the thing, which has gotten rave reviews, you would hope that it would become much more than just a niche player in this market. So I sensed definite disappointment. I think the guy deserves a lot of credit for making this happen because, in fact, it is beginning to happen.
Okay, Steve. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Steve Stecklow is Deputy Boston Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. For years, an NGO called the International Organization for Migration has worked with governments in Africa and Europe to protect immigrants from the worst dangers and abuses arising from illegal flight to the European Promised Land. TV advertising in Senegal, for instance, shows a mother desperate for the help of her oldest son, not knowing he is drowned en route to his supposed new life. But now the IOM is running another spot, financed by the Swiss government, with a strikingly different message.
Bonjour. Oui, papa, c'est Christian.
Ah, Christian, bonsoir.
The ad shows an apparently middle-class young man who has traveled to Switzerland phoning his father in Nigeria to say everything is great, but the ad makes clear that the immigrant is lying, flashing images of his life of hardship, poverty, and, it seems, crime. The message at the end, leaving is not always living. The ad has sparked accusations of xenophobia and even racism, funded as it was by a government that came to power on the strength of extreme anti-immigration rhetoric. But IOM spokesman Jean-Philippe Chosy says the ad accurately conveys the situation for African immigrants.
The reality today is, whether it's in Switzerland or in Europe or elsewhere in the world, is that migrants who are struggling in a country of destination that have enormous difficulties making ends meet, when they reach out to their family back home, they never tell the full story because the full story is often too painful.
These campaigns come from governments that are at the moment right of center and have been elected largely on immigration issues. It would be very easy to jump to the conclusion that the goal here is not really a humanitarian one, but to just keep black people out of Switzerland. Like, you know, stay home. Really, it's not so great here.
Well, look, this is a campaign, the one you're referring to, that goes beyond the internal Swiss politics. This is essentially a campaign to try and save lives or to try and make sure that people take no risk when they want to immigrate, to encourage them to immigrate legally. What you've got to bear in mind, too, is that we work with our government partners in countries of origin to get the message across that irregular migration is not a viable option.
In the Swiss ad, the thrust of it is, don't be misled, Switzerland is not the land of milk and honey. Don't come here thinking that you're coming to paradise, which is an odd positioning for a country to take. Usually it's like, you know, come to Switzerland, but this is not so fast. What steps did you take to try to minimize the appearance that you're just trying to keep Switzerland and the rest of Europe lily white?
Look, this is a very superficial comment, one that is in a way very hurting. Our goal is to preserve lives, to make sure that people do not die, whether they come from Africa or other parts of the world, when they're trying to reach Europe. Our goal in all parts of the world is to provide unbiased information so that people can decide and take the legal option for migration and turn their back on those smuggling networks that over and over again have shown their total disrespect for migrants.
Did you have some sort of research suggesting that people in sub-Saharan Africa were somehow unaware of the risks of human smuggling?
Well, I think that people are more aware today than they were a few years ago, if only because there's been increased media coverage of the dramas of irregular migration. What people don't realize is that many thousands and more undocumented migrants find themselves stranded in countries of transit, such as North African countries. And there again, because they are undocumented migrants, their fundamental rights are being, you know, regularly abused. And that also applies to undocumented migrants who arrive in Europe because of their status are made particularly vulnerable to all forms of abuse.
All right. Jean-Philippe, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jean-Philippe Chosy is head of media and public information for the International Organization for Migration. We'll be right back. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited this week mainly by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ian Whitehead and Jessica Magaldi. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.